Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And some thoughts now on President Obama's Middle East speech. We'll get to the Israeli-Palestinian part of it that's making the biggest headlines. But here is one central clip from the speech that I think is being overlooked, in which the president tries to put an extra nail in the legacy of Osama bin Laden.
Bin Laden was no martyr. He was a mass murderer who offered a message of hate, an insistence that Muslims had to take up arms against the West and that violence against men, women, and children was the only path to change. He rejected democracy and individual rights for Muslims in favor of violent extremism. His agenda focused on what he could destroy, not what he could build.
We'll hear more clips from the president's speech and two clips from a leader of Hamas who spoke to NPR. But with us now for his take is Steve Call, president of the New America Foundation think tank, New Yorker magazine contributor, and author of books including The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. Steve, thanks so much. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, good to be back with you. I got my credit card out when we're done.
Oh, okay. You don't have to talk about that, honey. So lost in the Israeli-Palestinian stuff, I think, is that part of the motivation for this speech, which was to further persuade the world's Muslims that bin Laden ideology should die with bin Laden. How much do you think the president was addressing certain global audiences with the clip that we just played?
I think to some extent he wanted certainly to remind them of something that I think most Muslim audiences around the world already know, which is that bin Laden's legacy does not include positive political ideas. He died in isolation, not just physically in Pakistan, but in the minds of his, putative followers in the Muslim world, he had not brought forward politics that Muslims themselves recognized as constructive. Instead, he brought forward violence in which most often the victims were, in fact, the very Muslims in whose name bin Laden claimed to be acting. So I thought it was in the aftermath of the Obama administration's raid in Pakistan and bin Laden's death, I thought it was smart for the president to connect bin Laden's death to the Arab Spring in the way that he did.
Were there certain parts of the world, countries or even parts of countries that you thought he was addressing there? For you as a chronicler of bin Laden and al-Qaeda, could that speech have made a difference as to whether al-Qaeda gets stronger or weaker from here on in certain areas?
I don't think that the United States is a credible enough voice, to be honest, about these issues in the Muslim world to really persuade many people just from a single speech. President Obama is still very popular personally abroad, but when he speaks as the President of the United States, I think many audiences in the Muslim world bring certain innate skepticism to his urgings. I do think that the United States has an opportunity this year and in this flowering of political debate in the Muslim world to continuously make the observation that the president made yesterday, which is that Obama lost the war of ideas. That doesn't mean that the United States won, but it does mean that as Arab societies redefine their own politics, there is an opportunity for the generation that's rising, this Facebook generation, to break away from the old radicalisms, both Islamist radicalism and secular radicalism in the Middle East, and try to construct something new. And I do think Obama speaks to that, both through his own achievement in being elected and in the kinds of language, the kinds of speeches that you just pulled that clip from.
There were two words that he failed to utter, which happened to be the name of bin Laden's home country, Saudi Arabia, America's gas station. He mentioned other allies that are resisting the Arab Spring, but how much do you think, you know, the on-the-street Muslim world cares, and I realize that's extremely diverse from country to country, but still, and not just journalists like us caring, that he let the Saudi royal family off the hook yesterday?
I think it matters a lot. I think that Muslim audiences listening to a speech like that are very attentive to the inconsistencies. That is what they are. Their radar is most acutely tuned to. They know that the United States has accommodated despots out of self-interest or out of security interests or out of energy interests for half a century or more in the Middle East. And when even an appealing president like President Obama comes forward and speaks about universal values, the audiences abroad, and particularly Muslim audiences, but not only those, listen and say, yes, I agree about your framing of universal rights, but now let's go to the case studies. Let's talk about your own consistency. And when, as yesterday, the president in a somewhat lawyerly way goes country to country and tries to rationalize, for example, accommodation of Bahrain's repression, leaves Saudi Arabia out altogether, and then celebrates the uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia. You can bet people noticed that.
Steve Call, my guest on WNYC, contributor to The New Yorker, president of the New America Foundation, and author of books including The Bin Ladens, an Arabian Family in the American Century. And let's get to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The reaction that I'm seeing indicates that the president kind of left both sides cold. We'll play two clips. The Israelis did not like this.
We believe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states.
So Prime Minister Netanyahu coming to Washington today did not like the specific reference to 1967 borders, even with the land swaps also mentioned, which would presumably allow Israel to keep the settlements right around Jerusalem. And the Palestinians did not like this.
The full and phased withdrawal of Israeli military forces should be coordinated with the assumption of Palestinian security responsibility in a sovereign, non-militarized state.
The president saying in one breath that every country has a right to defend itself and then citing Israel's right, but in the next saying a state of Palestine would have to have no military. So, Steve Call, did he accomplish anything regarding Israelis and Palestinians yesterday? As far as you could tell, all I feel like I'm hearing is sniping from both sides.
Yeah, I mean, accomplish is a big word when you're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in general. I think the president, you know, had a whole series of difficult, bad choices, and he ended up in the middle, I think, of the options that he was considering. He could have done nothing. He could have just glossed over the issue and, by doing so, endorsed the status quo, which is a stalemate heading to a very difficult autumn when the UN will consider a proposal to recognize a Palestinian state in the General Assembly. And I think the president, recognizing that this is going to be a tough year for Israel at the UN, wanted to do something to try to get ahead of that problem by addressing, again, the imperative of a settlement and a two-state solution. So he chose to articulate some of these principles a little bit more explicitly, a little bit more specifically than the United States had done in the past. It was not a sea change, but it was an incremental more explicit articulation of American policy. What he didn't do, what some of his aides had developed as an option and wished that he had done, was to put forward an even more detailed plan for a settlement or a basis for negotiations, and then follow that up with a kind of action plan for engagement negotiations. That would have irritated the current Israeli government even more. And in any event, there's no reason to think that the time is especially ripe for such an initiative.
Right. Well, explain a little more, if you can, what he did with the language that we played that was even new. Was it just mentioning the year 1967? Because, again, looking at both sides on this, on the 67 borders plus land swaps, I think this is what every serious person who's been involved in negotiations in the Clinton administration and the Bush administration on both sides in Israel-Palestine have always believed will be the case. 1967 borders, but with Israel keeping the core Jewish settlements that are around Jerusalem and other kinds of land going to the Palestinians so they can have a contiguous state. And with respect to the Palestinian side, everybody thinks that the new Palestine would be a demilitarized state. That's part of every serious person's solution. So what was actually new there that got anybody ticked off?
Well, I think it was just the gap between what serious people knew to be true, which I think you described accurately, and the location of that understanding in official presidential policy before the world in a big global speech, which no president had quite done before. So presidents, I think, I haven't gone back and looked at the full archive of presidential sort of speech making and secretaries of state, but in the past, there's been a bipartisan consensus among presidents and secretaries of state to say a two-state solution negotiated by Israel and a legitimate Palestinian leadership is what we support. But they have not said that the two-state solution should explicitly be based on the 1967 borders. They've left that to the negotiators, even though, as you say, in private, all serious people know that that's actually the easiest part of the negotiation,
right,
is the borders. The refugees and Jerusalem are the tough parts.
Right, and that was in the plan that they offered Arafat back at the end of the Clinton administration that he turned down. I also want to get your reaction to two clips of a Hamas official who went on All Things Considered with Robert Siegel this week. This was before the speech, but I find it very interesting in light of the speech. This is Hamas Deputy Foreign Minister Ghazi Hamad. He was asked how Israel could negotiate peace with the Palestinian government now that includes Hamas, whose charter calls for Israel not to exist at all. And this is what he said.
First of all, I think people should not judge Hamas according to the charter, because many changes happen inside Hamas. But maybe people in United States, in the West, or in Israel, they say, no, Hamas is still as it is before 20 years. No, I think Hamas show a lot of flexibility, and it became more pragmatic, more realistic. Hamas could be a good player in making peace in this region, but please don't use a stick against them and punishment against Hamas.
So Hamas Deputy Foreign Minister Ghazi Hamad with Robert Siegel on All Things Considered saying, don't judge us by the charter. We could be a good player for peace. And he went on to also invoke the 1967 borders by name, saying with that as a basis, even Hamas would consider peace with Israel. Listen.
We said, frankly, we accept the state in 67 borders. But the question now should be directed to Israel. We need a clear answer from Israel, because Netanyahu said that we will not go back to the 67 borders. We will not evacuate settlements. So we still the victims of the occupation.
Ghazi Hamad of Hamas with Robert Siegel on All Things Considered. So, Steve Call from The New Yorker and the New America Foundation, how much do you dismiss those answers? This is what I found myself thinking, hearing that interview. How much do I dismiss those answers as just propaganda by Hamas for an American audience? Or how much do you think that Hamas really would make a peace treaty based on 1967, drop the rejectionism, the total rejectionism of any peace with Israel, and that we really should look past the rejectionist language of the charter and lots of anti-Semitic language that's in that 20-year-old document as well going forward?
Well, I think it's sort of laughable for a spokesman for an organization to say, don't judge us by our written charter. If the charter doesn't represent you, then rewrite the charter. But, you know, having said, and I don't think Hamas's record would give you great confidence about their, their ability to organize themselves around the legitimately more moderate sections of their own organization. They've had trouble reconciling their own internal discourse. I would just say, of course, Hamas has the potential as a legitimate element of Palestinian public opinion and society, however coercive, however radical, however sort of ugly it sometimes looks to us. It does have the potential to evolve into a constructive political partner of Fatah and potentially even of Israel. And it has tried in its own mind to shuffle toward positioning that would allow it to participate in a successful negotiation with Israel. But I do think that it is completely legitimate for Israeli leaders to first point to Hamas's record of violence and anti-Semitism, and second, to the charter and similar declarations, and ask, how do we construct a durable settlement with a partner that doesn't have the courage to acknowledge Israel's existence as part of the call and response of any negotiating process. You would at some stage say, yes, we are here. We may disagree about everything, but we're here as legitimate negotiating partners. And, you know, so that's where we are.
So to cycle back around to where we started with bin Laden, why did the leader of Hamas denounce the raid against bin Laden if Hamas has been running around for years saying, no, no, we're not some global Islamist organization. We just want our rights from Israel?
Well, they've got a terrible PR department in general, Hamas, but they also are playing to their own constituents and what they imagine their own constituents want to hear. And you know, there certainly was a strain even in Pakistan among people who had no truck for bin Laden of offense and humiliation about the unilateral ability of the United States to raid Pakistan and kill bin Laden. So I suppose that's some of what they were speaking to. But you know, one thing about Hamas in the current environment is that they're just as insecure as some of the despotic Arab governments around them about the Arab Spring, because the youth on the streets in Egypt and Tunis and elsewhere are not chanting Hamas's slogans. This is a secular, by and large secular, certainly diverse and self-determined generation. And I think Hamas rightly feels threatened by what that means for their kind of old-think radicalism.
Well, hopefully that can bring good change, and we will see what happens this weekend as Netanyahu visits America. Steve Call, president of the New America Foundation, New Yorker magazine contributor and author of books including The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. Thank you so, so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Our next guest will be Weekend Edition Sunday host Leanne Hansen. She is retiring after 22 years, and we're going to have what I think will be a really fun little exit interview with Leanne Hansen coming up next.